Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is producer, musician, and remixer Danny Saber. Danny's worked with musical legends like David Bowie, Sheryl Crow, Marilyn Manson, U2, The Rolling Stones, Public Enemy, Willie Nelson, Ozzy Osbourne, Alice Cooper, and Madonna, among many others. He's also contributed to television commercials for McDonald's, Taco Bell, and Coors, and soundtracks for films such as Blade 2 and Moulin Rouge. Most recently, Danny's been busy working on some recently discovered songs by the late INXS frontman Michael Hutchence, as well as a documentary on the singer's life. During the interview, we spoke about his early band days around Hollywood, getting into remixing, producing the Rolling Stones, why producing a film is way different from composing, hanging with football legend Jim Brown, and much more. I spoke with Danny via Zoom from his studio in Los Angeles. You know, I want to go back to the beginning with you about when you started in the music business, how you started.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. Well, you know, in the music business proper, I mean, when I was a kid, you know, at about 11, I saw a poster of Jimi Hendrix, bugged the crap out of my dad for 2 years and got a guitar for my 13th birthday. And took about 2 years. By the time I was about 15, you know, I wanted to be the world's greatest guitar player, like all kids do. But, you know, the drum machines and keyboards, I got into keyboards because we used to have this thing in LA called the Recycler. And they would always have, like, you know, musicians seeking bands, musicians wanted. And it's like musicians seeking bands, and there'd be like 3,000 guitar players looking for bands. But then there was always this category of, like, you know, musicians wanted, guitarists that doubles on keyboards or something like that. So, I remember for about 2 weeks, and I went on an audition for this. It was like pros only recording situation, da 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 da. And it ended up being like this really rich Israeli lady, I guess. And then this guy, Jed Edwards, this black guy, and he was sort of her producer, and they were putting a band together. And I went to audition as a keyboard player, and I had literally only been playing keyboards like a few months. And the other guy that was auditioning was, he was like, you know, he had the kind of, remember all the musicians in the 70s had that, like, Paul McCartney issue, Eric Clapton haircut, you know, kind of. And he was a really good piano player, but very Nicky Hopkins-y, very traditional. You know, she's like, no, I need you to play more funk. Can you play it more funky? And then I got up there, and the only thing I knew how to really play was like a couple of Prince songs and The Time, and I could do the little Jesse Johnson. I got the gig. And I ended up in that band with that guy, Jet, who was like, you know, I was probably 17 and he was 27. And, you know, we ended up, like, you know, getting a residency in Phoenix. And it was the first time I ended up like earning any money. I thought I had made it. You know, I was in a cover band playing the remnants of the Chitlin' Circuit in like the late, you know, in the mid 80s. And Jet Edwards and the Jet Set. But that was my first professional gig. You know, we did covers and we played in like, well, I wasn't even old enough to be in the place. And, but it was pretty cool, man. And then, you know, and then I was earning, you know, $100 a week from playing my guitar and a little keyboards. So I was just, I had made it, man, you know. But the way I really got in the music business was cut back to, you know, I'm back in LA and kind of all this was going on sort of at the same time. But a few years later, I got introduced to this girl, Issa. Her name is Melissa Wilson, but her stage name was Issa June. And she had like one of those Portis. You know, remember the TX, like the reel to reels, but they were sort of self-contained. They had the mixer built in and they folded up. It was like a hat, like a quarter inch hat. And I had a set, by then I had gotten a sampler and, you know, I had a drum machine. So we kind of pooled our gear and had this little project studio. And her stepdad was really cool. You know, it was up in the Hollywood Hills and it was sort of in this, you know, like clubhouse behind their house. And I had access to it, even if we weren't working on our stuff. So I would record demos with anybody that would come over. And that led to me hooking up with Bronx Style Bob, I think was the first guy. And then got introduced to Guy O'Siri, and Guy was still in high school at the time. And he had a Stable of Art. I was sort of the producer, and he ended up getting the A&R gig at Maverick, and the rest was history. We had a band. I had a band called Proper Grounds with Sean Kennedy, and Guy was our manager. And guess who was the first artist signed to Maverick?
You guys.
Which was a double-edged sword. I mean, Madonna announced our signing on Arsenio Hall. You know, like, our signing made MTV News, and it's not the best thing for an artist that's never done anything. But, you know, it was cool, though. It definitely was high profile, and it sort of launched my whole career, got me a publishing deal with a little money in the bank. I was able to get EMI Publishing to send me to England, and that's where I connected with Sean Ryder. And that's what led to ultimately that big poster behind me. So that, in a nutshell, sort of how it all shook out, you know?
How about making the transition from a player to a producer?
Well, I never really made a transition because I always was both. I mean, I always was pretty much in every band of consequence, I was in the band. Like with Proper Grounds, it was a studio project. But in order to finally kind of get over the hump, because we were like, this is always funny. I always say this. There were two buzz bands in LA at the time. It was us and Rage Against the Machine. And that was the two bands at that moment everyone was looking at signing. But we had never done a show, you know, and in no way, shape, or form am I comparing us to Rage Against the Machine. All I ever say is, do you know how good Rage Against... Imagine going to see those guys as an unsigned band. They had those songs. They were so... But anyways... So what we had to do is I had like about 11 days to put a band together to showcase for Madonna. And all the guys, like he was the Sandman. They're all like, so the band was all fronted by, we had like five black guys, and we were doing metal and hip hop, but it was all sample based. And this is in like 1992, and with a live band. So I had 11 days to kind of take all this studio stuff that was already way ahead of its time and figure out how to do it live. And we put a band together, and, you know, those guys were super plugged into the club scene. So we played at the Music Machine, and probably 600-700 of our friends showed up and packed the place. And I mean, you know, Madonna showed up and we crushed it, and we got signed. So I always say the only reason I learned how to do all this sampling and all the stuff was so I could play my guitar. Because I figured out pretty quickly, if you're the producer, guess who gets to play guitar on the record?
Yeah.
And then just sort of by default, I ended up picking a bass up at one. Somebody didn't show up. And I'm like, wow. You know, but it wasn't like I'm playing with like a pick following the guitar. I could actually had a feel for playing the bass. And that's sort of always been, I think I recognized in an early age, for early in my development, that I wanted to be Jay Graydon and Andy Van Halen, or had those kind of chops. But I always had a knack for was putting stuff together and kind of knowing what to put.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's something I really think we need to focus and talk about more, is everybody's so honed in on how to play, you know, and you put these kids now, these little 11-year-old girls playing a Russian. I mean, she would tear me a new asshole, and they're amazing, but there's not a lot of emphasis placed on what to play and the choices you make and where does that come from? And, you know, and carving out your own little niche, you know? And when you're a kid, all you want to do is be able to play the eruption note for note or whatever it may be. You want to be able to, you know, that's the hottest kid in high school who can, you know, but I was always too, you know, ADD or like whatever. I learned, I know the intro to every song ever written, but then I'd go make my own shit up. And at the time I was kind of, but it was really did me way more service in the long run than being able to just mimic, you know?
Yeah, yeah. After a while, you became one of the kings of remixing. How did that happen?
Well, it was just funny enough. I was just having a conversation with a guy, and I'm going to do him a service. I'm going to mention his name, even though I don't know if we're going to end up working together. He's a really nice guy. He's doing sort of industrial-based. His band's called Shen. It's funny. I just had this exact Controlled Demolition by Roth. And, I was really, it was Guy who really started me on that path, because at this point I had done the Proper Grounds record, and Guy's like, you need to do remixes. Because remember, just getting in the studio, you needed a budget, you needed money. I mean, it was, you know, $1,000, $1,500 an hour to get in a studio in those days. And that was early 90s money. And I'm like, well, what do I got to do? And he goes, just take the vocal and make a new track. And I'm like, okay. And my first remix was Information Society. And my second remix was a Madonna remix, which a song called Waiting, which Guy completely like skirted the whole Sire promotion department and went straight to Madonna, got me. And I did this remix when Everlast came in. And it was right at the time Jump Around was huge and did a rap on it. And it was great because it got me in the studio. It gave me more time to kind of work on my skills. And they came out quick. Like you did the remix. Because remember, it was always for the next single. But what I was, the conversation I was having with the demo guy was like, there was always a purpose too to the remixes. Like the first, I did a Marilyn Manson remix of Beautiful People. It's called The Remix. And, you know, there were parameters, like they were trying to accomplish something with it, you know, and they weren't getting the traction they wanted in the UK. So it was right after the Black Grape had come out. So they wanted to do something for the UK that would help get Manson out there more. So, you know, and then Manson like had this idea of doing like some big band Jim Thirlwelly fetus thing, and we talked about it. But there was they served a purpose usually. There was usually some sort of, you know, angle. It wasn't just like random, let's do remixes, you know. And there's a long history of remixes breaking bad, you know, the mic. Happy Mondays, Hallelujah, and Primal Scream, those guys, those remixes broke those bands in some cases. So, you know, that was sort of the golden age of remixing. And I'm kind of lucky to be on the kind of cusp of that. And the painful too.
I have to know about working with the Rolling Stones. And the reason why I bring this up is because I've talked to several people who have worked with them, and their reaction has been pretty much the same. So I want to know if your reaction was the same when you first started to work with them.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't really need to be else's point of view is for me, you know, and it's interesting because Michael sort of was the conduit that opened that door, because I got sent. Michael had been working on the solo stuff outside of the band he was in, and outside of NXS. First thing I did was, you know, once I heard the demos and we talked and kind of hit it off on the phone, I went over to him. And after the first or second night, you know, Michael was like the first real international rock star I got to work with, you know. And we all went out, you know, expensive dinner and then to the club, and we were kind of dodging paparazzi. So I got to experience all that with him for the first time. So we're in a club called Brown's, and Mick and Ronnie walked in. And I'm like, dude, the closest I'd ever been to Mick Jagger, like I always say, was like, you know, my first concert was the famous, the 81, the tour that Prince opened for them, got booed off the stage at the LA Coliseum. So next thing I know, I'm sitting face to face with Mick Jagger, and him and Michael are sort of exchanging pleasantries. And Mick happened to be working on a solo record at the time too. And Michael was like, oh, you got to work with Danny. He just did Black Grape. And my, oh, Black Grape. And da, 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 da. So that sort of initiated that. And by the time I actually got to work with the Rolling Stones, I mean, there was a process to it. You know, it started with spending a day in the studio with Mick on some solo stuff. And that didn't end up working out because he didn't end up making that record. But then getting a call a few months later and, hey, Danny, sorry, I didn't move out with my solo record. I just put it on the side, but I was wondering if you'd be interested in working with my band. It's like, okay, you're right. You've got to come meet Keith. So then I went down to the studio, and they were locked out at old Ocean Way and the big Ocean Way. And they were just in there sort of running material, and it was Charlie and Daryl, Keith and Mick. Ronnie wasn't there. And you know, kind of came in and said hello. Right, Danny, can you play the Wurlitzer? Sir? I'm like, yeah, I can play little keyboards. Going back to my, you know. And we just went in the room and just started jamming. And luckily, I could sit there, find a part, and fall in without, you know, sounding like a complete imbecile. And that was sort of my job interview, you know. But I mean, it was magical. I mean, just being around those guys. And for me, personally, it reinforced, like, you know, when you're on the way up, and, you know, you meet these guys, you might, you know, we had a demo deal with Sony. Let me tell you, Dad, and here's the way it works. And this is, and they're all, you know, these guys are fun. They're usually negative, and, you know, you know, you'll never make it again. It's a rap, blah, 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 blah. Then you get around the Rolling Stones and you see, hey, man, it just reinforces so much shit you always thought and believed, you know? And it's sort of like I always say, it's like rock and roll graduate school, man. You know, like that's getting your master's in rock and roll.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was fantastic. And I got to go out on the road with them a bit, just hang out. I was just having this other conversation. The opening night of the Bridges to Babylon tour, I flew to the night before I went to Chicago and, you know, showed up at the dress rehearsal and I hadn't seen them since the record. And I wasn't sure how I would be received. And the daddy, man, it's so great. And he's like, how are you getting to the show tomorrow? I'm like, I don't know. He goes, meet me at the service elevator, you know, at 11 o'clock. And I got to ride in the motorcade with Mick, you know, police escort, opening night, Rolling Stones, North American tour. And I mean, you know how it was back then. They took over the city.
Yeah.
You know, especially on the opening night of a tour. It was mad, everything about them, man. It was like everything you could imagine and more, you know? But what are these, now that I've told you my side of it, what was the other people's responses to it? And when did they work with them? Is it recently or was it a long time ago? Or what was the time frame that worked?
Ed Cherney told me, and he worked on 5 of their albums after you.
Well, Eddie, they just closed the record. And I just did a post. And the reason I had a production suite in the record plant, but Ed's wife, Roseman Cherney, ran the record plant.
Yeah.
And thanks to, like, the first thing she did was call Eddie, because I had just worked with Eddie was the first person I met when I walked in that room that first day. And I mean, I said, you'd be hard pressed to find a more likable human being that ever existed.
Yeah.
Eddie was sweetheart.
Well,
what did Eddie say?
Well, he said that the very first, I think they were in France recording, and he said, and Don was producing, and he said that the first rundown of a song, they both got down underneath the console and they're going to each other, do you believe this? That's the Rolling Stones. We're here. Wow. Are we worthy? You know, one of those things. And here's people that have had a lot of hits, you know, and, you know, the Stones had that kind of effect on everybody.
No, without a doubt. I mean, and the thing is, the crazy thing is, and look, Eddie and Don were probably way more seasoned than I was. One of the surreal moments is one of the best things about being around the Stones too was all the other people that are just hanging out. So, you know, Mick's like, Daddy, I want you to play bass on this song Out of Control. We had already done Gunface and that I'm really, really well. And he's like, I love you, you like my bass playing, right? But the thing was, I'm in the live room, Keltner, Charlie Watts, Keith Richards, Mick. But Daryl Jones and Doug Wimbush are like in control. So I would say it's like Jordan and Kobe are on the bench and I'm in the game. It's like, you know, you'd think those guys would be like, well, what the fuck, you know, we should be. And they were, dude, they're like my big brothers now. I mean, they were so supportive because I was a kid. When you look at it in context, you know, I wasn't even 30 yet, I don't think. And I was a kid. It was like, you can count on two hands the records I had.
That's cool.
You know, so yeah. But I think what you realize too is when you're in that situation, it's like Eddie Murphy in Trading Places when he's in the back seat of the car. They're like, you can get up, walk out right now. I believe I can hang out with you guys for a while. So make yourself useful and have something to offer. You know, maybe they'll let you stick around a little bit, you know, but you got to get over it. It's like, yeah.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, they're no different than any other artist. I always say there's not that much of a difference. Once you get over the fact of who they are and what they've done, you know, they're all looking at Mick was very, very, Mick's very, like he's one of those people, all of them, you know, and he's like, you know, Danny, they come in at 5 o'clock. Mick wants to work till 1, then he wants to go out and do his thing, you know, but for those 6 hours, man, you're using every fiber of your being, you know, just trying to hang. And it's not about the musical situation. That is what it is. But it's just the whole environment, you know? Like someone like Fowler, who was one of my closest friends, but, you know, he's been in that part of that camp now for, what, 30 years? You know, just to maintain and just to you know, to continue to operate, you know, takes a certain kind of, like, you know.
All right. So at some point you got into doing music for picture, commercials, TV, films. So how did that come about?
Well, funny enough, you know, when I was young, getting into it, I would have done anything. I mean, like I said, I started out in a cover band doing a couple of songs in a residency in Phoenix, Arizona, playing for 50 to 100 drunk divorcees every night. And I was, you know, like a pig in shit. I was so happy at that stage. So you keep growing and you start to see things like, you know, no one's sitting here thinking, yeah, I'm going to produce the Rolling Stones like that. Oh, I'm going to produce like that, you know. And it was sort of the same with the movie thing. It was always something I wanted to do. And it was really more what I saw myself doing. The shit that happened, I never could have imagined. But trying to break into doing, song, you know, music for film and TV and all that was always what I really saw myself doing and wanted to do when I was, you know, coming up and young. And what happened was there was a movie called The Jackal that was directed by Michael Caton Jones. And Michael, his big movie was Rob Roy, and he did Scandal. Scandal was his breakthrough movie. Then he did Rob Roy. He's a fantastic director. Scottish guy, great guy, fucking great. And he loved Black Grape, right? And in The Jackal, it was Bruce Willis, Sidney Poitier, Richard Gere. It was a remake of Day of the Jackal. And he had put, like, I think he's probably the first person to put, like, Teardrop in a movie. So he had all this real cool British, like, of that period trick. He, you know, because there was some unbelievable music that came out of the UK in the 90s. But the score had been done by Carter Burwell. And Carter was an amazing guy in Arizona. And he's sort of more known for that quirky sort of stuff. But it was a political thriller. And the score was, it was a great score, but it was very drastic from this cutting edge new music as the source music. And then the score, which was very orchestrated and sort of political thrillery, Hollywood by the numbers sort of thing. So he's like, I'm really not happy with the score. You know, is there anything you could do? And I go, well, I don't know. Let's go watch the movie. So we watched the movie together. And I'm like, yeah, let's just remix the score. You know, let's put some beats underneath it and some percussion. And we can do some stuff to spice it up. And so it's not so drastic. It feels more cohesive. And it was great because I got to literally go scene by scene with a great director. Here's what's not working. Here's what's working, whatever. And, you know, I've been working my way down ever since. You know, that was the best thing. But I did a season of network television. So, you know, I've sort of, it's one of those things where, like, it's hard to legitimately do it because there's so much politics in it. So I really fell into the role of the fix-it guy. And they'd come to me when they were out of money and the music. Because also remember, the music is always the last component in the process. So any movie, I don't care what it is, and I said this, I learned this producing the Michael Hutchins documentary, because when you're not, until you're on the producing side of it, as a composer, you're like, why are they doing this? And they're so stupid. And da 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 da. And you've got this sort of arrogant, standoffish attitude. But when you get on the other side of it and you see all the shit that's, and all the moving parts and all the neurosis that went into whatever, 10, 15 years sometimes to get a movie made, you know, you realize, A, you know, it's not as easy as you think it is. And B, it's all getting channeled into the music because that's the last sort of chance saloon to fix whatever, you know, perceived flaws there are. Like I was like, you never see anybody fighting over the color correction, but everybody's right. Got it, you know, and then it's like the 11-year-old daughter of so-and-so doesn't like that song. And, you know, so all gets channeled into the music. And, you know, I would come in on my film specialty stuff. Like I got to work with Steven Soderbergh on this movie called The Limey. And there was this great 11-minute sequence where Terrence Stamp is at a party, but he's fantasizing killing Peter Fonda. So it had to sort of move between music that would be on at a Hollywood party in the hills and then these dream sequences and flashbacks that weren't actually happening. So it was kind of, and it was 11 minutes, which is like, you know, most scenes are what, a minute?
Yeah, right. Right.
Minute 30 is a long run for a piece of music in a movie. So, you know, stuff like that, I kind of got this little specialty sort of role. And then on the next one, it was always on the next one. But I mean, like, I got to work on a lot of really great. I got to work on Moulin Rouge. Same thing. I was brought in. I got a call. I guess 7 or 8 people had tried to do the Nirvana sequence, and Baz wasn't happy with it. And, I nailed it on the first try. And then I, next thing I know, I'm in a room with Baz Luhrmann, and it's, you know, so stuff like that. It was great. But it was Michael Gaine Jones along that, Bjorn Jacklin.
Okay, let's move up to today with the Michael Hutchence lost tapes. So how did you find the tapes? Did you find them or somebody else found them?
With the Michael, well, you know, it started when Michael was really the first, because Michael was always on this mission to discover new music, and was always listening. I remember one time we went to like the Virgin Megastore in London, and I mean, anything that looked remotely interesting to him, you know, take that. And then we went back. I remember he just starts ripping CDs up and putting them in, going through, next one, going through. I don't know what he was looking for, but he would just, he was on this search, you know, for this sound, you know. And I think when he heard the Black Grape record, because what NXS was so great at, you know, and what Michael, it was sort of a double-edged sword, I think. They were really the first band to integrate legitimate guitar music and guitars and rock with dance, funky, and as funky as you like, but they're still a rock band. And they mix those genres so perfectly. And I think because, you know, Michael's lyrics and the vocals were wrapped in dance music, he never really got the credit he deserved. I mean, because if you look at the, like, the subject matter and his lyrics, you know, I'll put it up against anybody. You know, he was an amazing writer. So I think, you know, and he had this need, I think, because when bands get that big, it becomes like the changing of the seasons. You know, it's like there's a push and a pull between maintaining what you've accomplished and still pushing it forward creatively. And Michael really had a need to always see how far he could take it, you know? And he needed that space outside of the band to just sort of be free to go wherever the fuck he wanted to go without the sort of, you know, and it's no knock against those guys. I mean, they all came out of the garage together, you know, and maybe from the outside looking in, Michael's sort of the focal point, but they're all equal. I mean, they're, you know, so the guitar player in the equal, because they came out of a garage, you know? So, you know, they all have their little land and their little territories, and having that opportunity, you know, just to have to work on stuff that was completely just built around him, you know? And if he put up an idea, a lot of times ideas come out in his head. It's like, he wasn't a conventional musician, but he had musical, like, oh man, that's a guitar part. Well, that's a, you know, whatever, that could be a cool keyboard part, whatever it may be. And just no fear of, like, going and, you know, where when you get in that band dynamic, it's like, well, that's not, we can't do that because that's not what we do. And, you know, so that was really the motivation. And, you know, we got a lot done in the 2 years we worked together. And then, you know, passed away. You know, that record got finished eventually. And kind of came out, kind of came and went, because there was no one to promote it. And it was a new label with V2. And it was my second or third record they put out. So somebody reminded me, they put that Moby record. That was huge. So, but it was the record. I mean, that Moby record was like the record. I don't mean, you know, as long as people heard it, they were going to buy it.
Yeah, right.
But cut to like about 10 years or so later, and I got, you know, because I was sort of the last close collaborator with Michael, and anybody that knew the situation, he was really happy with what we were doing, and was one of the real sort of bright spots, you know, right there at the end. And I was obviously the logical person. Hey, look, you know, there was a bunch of material at Surface, and it was stuff he had been working on outside of the band that, you know, when he was kind of working, he had his own studio, so he was probably working on stuff, you know, get an engineer to come in and get a beat going, you know, and he was trying stuff with different people, you know, and it was really a lot of ideas, about 30 ideas. So it's like, all right, well, let's see if there's even anything here, because it wasn't like there was eight, you know, things on a cassette with it, you know, it wasn't Cat Stevens, man. He wasn't sitting there. They were just beats and vocals for the most part with maybe a synth loop or something. And it was all on 2-inch tape. So it had to be digitized. It was a whole process just to figure out what the fuck was even there. But we grew it, you know, it became apparent, like, okay, you know, there's something here. But if we're going to start going down that road, like, what are we going to do with it? And that was sort of like where the whole idea of, okay, well, let's make a documentary, like, you know, we could sort of use the discovery of the music as a way to tell a story. And nothing had been done at that point. It was 2007 or 8, maybe. And that sort of set the table for everything where we are now. I mean, it's a long story. It took 7 years to get the movie made. Yeah. You know, and it went through a bunch of different parts, you know, because with music docs, it's really all about the direct. So, you know, we had traction. We had David Leitch was on board at one point, Mark Pellington. Then Julian Temple got pretty serious with him. We had a development budget, and he started to kind of do some research. And he brought in this girl was great, because it was before, like, every piece of footage that ever existed was on YouTube. So she amassed about 100 DVDs with everything she could find. And it was mostly like MTV news stuff. And, you know, but it gave us like a kind of solid foundation. And Julian ended up passing because, you know, he didn't want to ultimately tell the story. He had a relationship with Bob, and, you know, he didn't end up making the movie, but it gave us, it helped set the table to ultimately get it done with Channel 7. With this guy, Mark Llewellyn, he was amazing. He was the right guy to do it. And so the movie got made in 2017, and the plan always was it aired on Australian television. It was limited to there. We were going to recut the film, sell it internationally, and then the music, the collection of songs would accompany that release as a, you know, we got a lot of traction, but we never got anything across the line. When COVID hit, and like, it just delay after delay. And finally, I found myself in a position where it's like, you know what? The fans know about it. They had been knowing about it. They've been asking about it for years. Let's just put something out. Let's get something out and start to, you know, the time felt right now to do it. And it was like a big movie. You know, I've had a really good, solid relationship with the fan community, especially on Facebook. You know, there's a bunch of fan pages, and the administrators, you know, we've always been in touch, and they've always been really supportive. And, you know, just trying to keep my ear to the street, so to speak, and really listen to the fan base and let them have like kind of a voice in all of this. And we just announced we're going to do a single. It was funny because we did the single, and I didn't want to just like stick it on Spotify. It would have been over in 48 hours if I had aggregated it, right? So I'm like, it's too valuable. There's only 7 of these things. And, you know, so we did the vinyl single. And then a lot of the fans started requesting a CD version. So we just announced we're going to do a CD maxi single, but that all came from fans. Like, you know, so that's what I'm trying to do, is listen to them as we go forward, you know, kind of give the people what they want. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And so that sort of brings us to where we are.
Very cool, Danny. Very cool. I mean, it's a shame about Michael, but it's very cool that you've gone through this to remember him and also to bring new music, which I'm sure his fan base loves.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, it's been a really, really long road, and a lot of what I meant when, like I say, time was right to do it now is because, look, let's be honest, because I always thought I'd show, even when I lied, from Scarface, I always fell up to, like, Michael died under fucked up circumstances, man. Like, you know, and the one thing I've learned from all this is it doesn't matter if it's some friend that had a lot of friends around them, you know, or some famous international rock star. When you die, you leave behind an energy, you know, and a big part of that energy is the memory that's burning in people's minds in you. You know, it's interesting with the fan base because, and a lot of it, I think, is because of the way he died, but also because of the impact he had on people. You know, it's been consistent. You know, it's crazy when you think about it. 30 years ago, certain people have that. Jefferson had that. Jefferson has had that. Michael has that. And it's all because of what they inspired in people. You know, and what I wanted to see happen and what's starting to happen now is sort of healing. Like, there's been sort of this residue, and there's been a lot of negative energy around it. And it really feels now like the dust is starting to settle, and, you know, they deserve not just Michael, but NXS too, to take their place in the, you know, and be recognized for their greatness. I mean, they were the biggest band in the world there for a few years, and they had their own sound, their own niche, and they meet all the check marks, like with this whole Rock and Roll Hall of Fame thing. It's egregious at this point, but at the same time, without a, like, if everyone's bickering and it's going to be fighting and there's this negative energy, who's going to step up and
you need a Bono, you need a Simon Le Bon, somebody's got it. So I think it's a little more likely to happen now. And so if this helped a little bit, people are now thinking about him and remembering how to singer and why he was great and get away with it stuff. And that has happened. I mean, that was the most important thing to me in all of this. It was like, start the road to just shifting the sort of the narrative. You know what I'm saying? And it seems to be working. This has been, I couldn't have, it's been so well received. It's been real virtually negative, and it all started with the music. I mean, people love the music, and that's the one part of it you got no control over. You can't make people like the music. You got to put it out. It wasn't like Michael's shit and gold nuggets. I mean, even in excess, everything hit. Like, so I'm really pleased about that, just the way it's been embraced. And, to do it in 2024 ain't easy, because it's a completely different world we live in. So kind of tying the past to the present, and people hearing his voice again, and something fresh, I think it's been a good thing. It's been a really good thing.
All right, last question, Danny. What's the best piece of advice that maybe you learned along the way, or maybe somebody imparted to you?
Wow, that's a good one. That's an easy answer for me. And it has very little to do with the music. So I made a record with Alice Cooper, so I got to link it to some rock and roll.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm about to get into a sports thing. But I made a record with Alice Cooper like in 2008 called Along Came a Spider. And the two prerequisites for me getting the job were, okay, produce the Rolling Stones, you got like the pedigree, and you have the golf champ. Like, he was all about golf. He was in this, he used to say, I'm in the 300 club, which meant he played 300 rounds of golf a year. I knew nothing about golf at that point. And if you're not a golfer and people start explaining to you, it's like, yeah, I get it. Right? And he kind of planted the seed in me. Cut to, I start going to the driving range at 40 and trying to hit golf balls, and the first person I met was Jim Brown, football. And he was there every day and holding court because, I didn't know it at the time, but he just had like his fourth hip replacement. So he was working on getting his swing back, and then he had the chest board and, so I remember Jim Brown was like my guy. The whole thing was there was a driving range, it's a fantastic place. They just closed it down. It's heartbreaking. It's called Weddington Golf. So there's a driving range and there's a little nine hole sort of par three course. So every day Jim would be there hitting balls and then he'd go play the par three. And whoever got to play with him, there was three spots, was like kind of a deal. So I start to get to know all the regulars and they, and golf is just, it was nothing what I thought it would be like. I mean, if you golfers really have each other's backs, you start hitting balls and people are like giving you help and telling you which instructor to go to. So it was this environment of like, the last thing I thought golf would be. So I got to know this one guy, Manny, who played golf with Jim every day. So my thing was, I get to play with Jim. Right? And a couple times before that, he'd sort of been looking at me and I like, oh, hi, Mr. Brown. I had Mick Jagger in my house, right? I'm not like, I was wondering if, not right now, but. I have something I was hoping you might sign for me. Do you think you could do that sometime? And he, no. So finally, one day I see they're over there and I see Manny pointing and he kind of looks at me, like ask him, can Danny play with us? And so I played nine holes. And Jim said, so you're a new golfer then? Huh? I'm like, yeah. He goes, you got some potential. How'd you like to play some real golf sometime? And I'm like, yeah, I'd love to, right? So he goes, all right, give me a number. And write it on a piece of paper like a normal person, right? So I wrote my number down thinking, next morning, like 9 a.m., Danny, it's Jim Brown. You want to go play Mountain Gate Country Club with me? I mean, to play that. The first time I ever played an 18-hole golf course. Long story short, man, we really built a friendship over 10 years and he became like a father to me. With the one bit of advice, all that to get to the advice. And I have a knack, and a lot of it's cultural because I'm Jewish. So, people that always have to sort of put a bow on everything and have the last word. It's like, you always got to have the last word, motherfucker. Sometimes shit just is what it is. But the advice was, try not to think in absolutes. Because whenever you think in absolutes, like people, everything's in a box. And this is this. And this means that. And two is four. And it was just the best. It just like freed me. Because
especially with music, like you go into these situations and, you know, with the idea.
I've always been inclined to be that way. Like that's the thing I was talking about with Michael. Like we never, the only rule is there's no rules. We're going to go wherever it takes us. And 9 out of 10 times, the breakthroughs come from mistakes or accidents. You know, it's just being able to recognize them in the moment, capitalize on them, and let your ego go and go where it takes you, as opposed to my idea, though. But what about my idea? It's like, fuck your idea, dude. Listen to what's going on in front of your ears. So he kind of encapsulated all that. And again, it was reinforcing, like with the Stones or Jim Brown or U2, you know, these iconic people are those people for a reason. And like with Jim, it's, you know, yeah, he's the greatest athlete, arguably, of the 20th century, but he was also probably the smartest athlete, and he worked harder. Prince, yeah, that guy had more. It always makes me crazy. Oh, Prince had so much natural talent.
Yes, he did. But I guarantee you that motherfucker locked himself in a room at some point in his life and fucking played nonstop, and he worked his ass off. You know, so they all have that work ethic and that ability to just allow, balance that thing of allowing it to happen. Be taking whatever, just using it, not getting caught up in any bullshit. So that's it. Don't think in absolutes, man, especially in musical situations. Allow shit to take you where it wants to take you.
Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter at bobbyosinski.com. There you'll also find out about openings for my latest online classes and special events. That's bobbyosinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it in Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Mixcloud, YouTube Music, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.